Hello, RFN listeners. This is Guillaume, the editor. I just want to warn you that we unfortunately lost John's audio for new business. But don't worry, he'll be back when we answer your emails. So stick around and please enjoy.
Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 388. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, James Jones.
Hi.
John Lindemann. Guillaume Veillette.
Hello.
Hello, sir. We have so much to talk to you guys. We always run out of time before we get to talk about everything we want to, but we're going to try to move quickly through new business this week because I have a lot of listener mail lined up. We'll get through as much as we can. I promised last week we were going to do some catch up, and we will. But first up is new business, and let's start with James, because James, I know you've been playing Shovel Knight. Guillaume has also played through the entire game. And I've played a little bit, but I think the two of you guys are more qualified to kick it off. And, you know, Guy had sort of an introduction last week. I think I've played about as far into it as he had at that time. But the game is out this week. Our website gave it a 10. It's getting pretty amazing reviews around the board, and we don't have to talk about whether or not we agree with that or not. But, I mean, in general, there's a lot of buzz about this game, so I think it warrants a second week of being addressed here on the podcast.
Oh yeah. Like we barely touched it the first time.
Yeah.
So,
and you are our resident Mega Man freak, James, although I'm also a pretty big fan, and Guillaume and John certainly have had their good times with that series as well, but I'm really curious to hear how you feel like it holds up to that legacy that it is. I mean, it's very directly mining it.
So that's a bad pun. But so
okay.
So it's less Mega Man than it was when we first saw it over a year ago. I think the game's gone and put a lot more exploration into it since from what we saw. Remember, we only saw part of one stage.
I think it was Pridemore Castle.
Yeah, it was part of Pridemore. It wasn't even the whole level. So
yeah, because I remember those big cat enemies that very reminiscent of the blue dogs in Mega Man 2.
And, actually,
they're griffins.
Yeah, whatever.
The griffins, yes, because they have their very la-di-da hand swipe that they don't really seem to care what you're doing.
Yeah.
I think my immediate reaction to the game, and I'm through five of the bosses at this point, maybe six.
Okay.
Is that I do really enjoy it. It's very well executed. I think it took an incredibly long time for this game to come out. And I say that not disparaging. It just felt like it took a very long time between when this game was announced, when we first saw it, and ultimately when it was released.
Yeah, and I think part of that is that – I think that's the nature of independent game development is that you have to show your game when there's not that much to it. It was a lot of concept art basically when they did the Kickstarter.
Sure, and that's going to my point. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately – what this game shows is that they really took their time with it. Because there's a lot of places in this game where things feel remarkably well crafted.
Yeah.
There's just pieces that seem to work really well together. And what I found was that there are some spots in the game where stuff isn't as nicely layered. But under a normal circumstances, I probably wouldn't even notice that. Like, I may think, well, this spot's kind of frustrating. Or, yeah, this spot's a little bit harder. But, you know, there's a situation I ran into in, like, the fourth dungeon I played where there's a platform that's moving and you have to climb a ladder to be high enough to jump onto the platform. And there's an enemy on the other side of the screen who shoots at a regular pattern. And then there's another flying enemy who flies back and forth and blocks your jump to the platform. And 96% of the time I play that game, all of that stuff works and the timing is perfect and you can do all of that stuff. Not with ease, but it's eminently apparent what you need to do. And considering how many moving parts are involved and how each of these things moves at a different rate under normal circumstances, because these are all parts they've lifted and used in other places, the fact they all sync up well is really nice.
And that is a hallmark of Mega Man, I would say, where they introduce you to enemies and level features early on, and then as the level goes on, and especially in the Wily stages when they bring those elements back and they sort of remix them, a lot of the design of the game is about putting these sort of familiar elements together in ways that are particularly devious or that make you approach an enemy that seems very simple, but because of the way the platforms are laid out or because of other hazards in the area, it makes it much more challenging to deal with that enemy, even though you kind of know what you need to do, but they've made it a lot trickier to get in the right position to do it. And I think Shovel Knight plays with that in a very similar way.
Yeah, and in this case, I'm four dungeons in, and it's the first time I noticed the timing's not right on all these things. So maybe the platform's there, but there's stuff in the way. The next time the platform's there, but there's a shot in the way. And then the third time, maybe all the timing's synced up and you can pull it off. But the fact that, like I said, 95% of the time they nail all those moving parts in sequence is really a sign of a game that's been played and played and played and tweaked. And every time they play it, they go and they tweak something to make sure it's exactly the way they want it to be. Mm-hmm. And that's really impressive because there are so many opportunities for things to, you know, be wrong, essentially. What I think, to your point about the sort of training that this game does, in a very Mega Man way, it'll introduce you to a stage hazard in a way that it can't kill you. So there's a good example in Pridemore, which is this tower, where these chandeliers that fall from the ceiling, if they hit you while you're jumping, you're going to get knocked back and you're going to fall into a pit. But the first three times or so it shows you a chandelier, they're just over open ground, and they fall before you have any realistic chance of being under them. And in fact, the fourth one actually hangs out longer, so you can see, if you try it, that actually you can jump up on them and climb across, even though they're going to fall. And they sort of bait you over there with some treasure. It's a very well-executed teaching moment where the game shows you that, A, yes, these fall. B, yes, they hurt you if they fall on you. But C, if you can do it fast enough, you can climb on them. Mm-hmm. And all of these things are taught without the use of a single word. It's very Mega Man-esque in that way.
Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out, because even the very first level, you know, the game opens with a cutscene and it sort of explains the background of Shovel Knight and his lady friend, Shield Knight. I guess their romantic involvement is left up ambiguous, at least in the intro. But she died, and now he's sort of avenging her after a period of retirement that kind of reminded me of like the outlaw Josie Wales, where he's like out in the field using a shovel for farming rather than for combat. The very first like prologue level that you go through, I was surprised that they throw you in this level and they don't try to explain the controls. They don't say anything about the mechanics. They don't even tell you that you can do that pogo thing.
Right.
You just get to a certain point in that level where that's the only way you're going to make it through there. So they figure there's not that many buttons that you can press in the game. You'll figure it out. And I was very heartened by that experience of that very first level, even though the first level is pretty easy and it's not the most interesting or exciting level, but they leave it to you to mess around and experiment with the controls and the mechanics to figure out the timing and all this stuff and to learn how you're going to be playing the rest of the game. And then you get to the town and then you talk to people who explain, they don't really explain much, but they give you hints. They suggest places where you might try to look for secrets. They tell you how to use certain items that you might come across. But I loved how that first level, they really just throw you in it and just let you go. And that's very old school. And it's not just nostalgic. It's not just done for the sake of being retro. I think it's a smart way to handle the game. And it is a simple game in a lot of ways. I mean, the complexity of it is in the subtleties. It's in the way that these things are combined. But on the very basic level, you jump and you attack with your shovel, and sometimes you push down and you bounce on top of enemies. I mean, it's not even worth explaining. It's better that you get in there. It's more about the feel of it and the timing of all that and learning to use those things to your advantage. And I love that they just let you figure
and
it out.
The important thing is that when you need to learn that stuff, they gate you and they say you really cannot proceed until you've learned it. Mm-hmm. But they also let you do it in a relatively consequence-free environment. So it's not frustrating while you're trying to figure out what to do. You're just stuck and you just keep trying things until you hit it. And that's a hallmark of both the original Mega Man series and the X spinoff. As they introduce these new concepts, they generally do it wordlessly, and they do it in a way where you have to learn it before you're able to actually proceed at playing the game any further.
It's kind of weird that this game is coming from former WayForward people. Like, just think of A Boy and His Blob when they didn't do really any of that stuff. They were just, okay, so we need to teach a player what to use here, so we're going to have a freaking billboard, and it's going to show that you're supposed to use this or that, you know? Like, oh, well, here you need a ladder.
Well, and that game's also really finicky. You know, there's a lot of there's a lot of weird stuff in A Boy and His Blob where you have to throw jelly beans at, like, very strange angles and try to get the blob to do things by sort of manipulating his, you know, really shitty AI to try to get him to do things in a very specific way, which I guess you could look at as a tribute to the original Boy and His Blob, which also was horrible. I mean, I think the WayForward one is far superior, but it's still lacking in that polish. And I think, you know, even having only played a couple hours, I think Shovel Knight is better than anything WayForward has ever made that I've played, certainly.
I'm on board with that.
But also what I'm really impressed by is that it doesn't just feel – it's not just a tribute to these old games, and it doesn't just look like those old games as a kind of an artifice. I feel like the people making this game actually understand what made those old games work on a very deep level that a lot of people who play it – may not fully grasp just why it feels that good. But I think the people making this understand those old games on a really deep technical design level. And to me, that's what makes this. It really sets this apart from a lot of other games that use pixel art and they use chiptune music and they use sort of familiar, like, you know, 2D platforming kinds
of structures. They reuse mechanics without necessarily understanding the subtlety of them. I think the one place where it falls down in that respect, and it's not in those places where all the pieces don't sync up, because even the best games of that era, Castlevania's, there's a lot of Super Castlevania 4 in play here. Mm. I mean, in fact, there's the fact that you can find chickens inside of walls is a very much a direct homage to that game.
Oh yeah,
but it's that sometimes it has this infinite life checkpoint system. Mm-hmm. Which is a very modern way of dispensing with what is a very arcade-inspired piece of artifice, where we're going to make this really hard and not give you a bunch of checkpoints, and we're just going to make you die and start over again. How they handle it is they have these checkpoints that are somewhat frequent, and there's lots of – essentially infinite life. What I think that they did almost mistakenly is they went and then made the levels incredibly long. Yeah. These are very long levels by the standards of the games they are based against.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times you can kind of see the game start to strain on kind of a, I don't want to say a lack of ideas, but when you reach the end of an era, you're like, okay, I'm fully done with Pridemore, or I'm fully done with the swamp. I'm ready to go on to the next place. And I wonder if maybe they'd have been better off doing what a lot of those games did, which is subdivide it into two pieces and then sort of change it up a little bit in the second half.
Well, I mean, I'm to me, that's the only... I want to hear from both of you guys, because you guys have seen most or all of the game. The first couple levels that I went through, there didn't really seem to be any reason to go back through that stuff. So if they're one and done, then I'm okay with them basically exhausting these ideas by the time you get to the end.
So there are these blue chests in them that you can use to buy artifacts. Yeah. And if you don't find them on the first pass through, and some of them are fairly well hidden.
But if you're thorough, I mean, they don't really gate things behind upgrades that you may not have yet.
No,
in some later Mega Man games.
But you may not have enough money to buy them when you run into them.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I found that the game was very generous with money. Like, the fact that when you die, you can collect back what the money that you lost from dying really helps.
Yeah, but I had a situation where I didn't have enough money because the chest was very close to the beginning of the stage. Mm. And I had just spent my money on upgrades. So I knew I was going to have to play that whole level over again.
Yeah, I do think it's a shame that if you go back in after you beat the boss, you can't just collect what you missed and then warp out. If you do that, it says you're going to lose everything you found. Right. And that's shitty. You know, yeah. I mean, like, Mega Man X was smarter than that.
But after the first two chests, like, when you realize, okay, so I found this hidden chest that cost me 1,000 gold, and then the second chest cost me 2,000 gold, you kind of know to expect that you're going to have to pay 3,000 or more.
Yeah, but you may not expect that it's going to be at the very start of the level.
No, that's true.
And as I said, some of them are better hidden than others. I think one place where this game diverges very heavily from Mega Man, besides the combat, is that it spends a lot of time on creating these tiers of hidden areas. There's the stuff that's very obviously, and I use air quotes for hidden. Like, it's not hidden at all. It's very explicit. This is a spot. Hey, you should hit this with your shovel. There are areas that are sort of this middle tier where maybe you just keep walking through a wall. But maybe there's some kind of visual clue that you can do that. And then there's the stuff that is really, really complexly hidden or requires some particularly intricate piece of platforming to get into where it needs to go.
Yeah, more the second than the first, I think. Like, there are two... I finished the game with a lot of lives lost, but also I finished with, like, 97% completion. Wow. I think that there's a lot of... Basically, all the secrets, all the ways that they hid stuff I've seen before from playing games like that, you know?
Sure.
So and I'm pretty sure I know where the two scrolls or like the two music sheets that I missed, that's the game's only collectible. I know where they are. I just know that I kind of bypassed them because they were hard to get, or because maybe I foolishly destroyed the checkpoint and then it would have been too much of a hassle to go back through the level and collect those.
So, I mean, I think to that end, one instance that I'm thinking of in particular that's a particularly kind of clever hiding is it's the...
Are you going to give away one of the best hidden spots in the game?
No, you won't know what I'm going to say. Well, you won't understand how to get there, but it's in this level in a graveyard where a lot of time is just spent just shadows on dark background. So you can't see anything unless there's a lightning bolt going on. Very little can be visibly seen.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's silhouetted. Yeah.
Yes, it's extremely Castlevania. Yeah.
And there's a fairly straightforward hidden area, although you can't make out the special texture that tells you this is a spot. If you hit it with your shovel, it'll blow away the wall. You just kind
of
have
sometimes
to.
You can just sort of intuit it. Like, it feels right. Like there should be a secret here because
a certain
percentage of the screen isn't really accessible. So,
and that's kind of
like
what
there's probably
here.
A secret area over there, and I just have to figure out how to get into it.
Right.
Like, that's the way the Wario Land games work a lot of times.
Sure.
It's like, there's no clue, except the clue is that there's not a clue. You know,
right.
the clue is that it just feels like there's something missing here, and there shouldn't
be. So that's what happens in that case. You hit it, and the wall falls away. But the real secret behind that one is if you walk all the way to the end of the area that opens up, and use the shovel again, another wall falls away and you end up with one of these music pages.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very clever little secondary hidden where you think, oh, I've got the gems, I'm out.
Right.
But there's actually more stuff there if you just keep walking.
Well, again, that's a very Metroid thing to do.
A secret upon
Super
a
Metroid
secret.
Pulls that off like 3 or 4 times. Yeah.
Right. I am absolutely thrilled with the quantity of secrets in this game. I mean, being a huge Metroid fan and of Wario Land as well, you guys know I love finding secrets in these 2D games, and Shovel Knight really sort of glorifies that kind of gameplay in a way that I wasn't expecting from this game, because it is mostly an action game. The game is mostly about, you know, jumping on platforms and killing enemies, and the secret stuff that they've put in here, a lot of lesser games wouldn't bother with this, or they would do like maybe one or two a level, but Shovel Knight, it feels like almost every single screen has something. If I just look, I'll find something. It may just be, you know, a little bit of treasure hidden in a wall. It's not a big deal if I miss it, but I want to always look for it.
And
one thing I like about it is that the stuff isn't hidden arbitrarily, you know. It's like it's much better designed than another game that it draws some inspiration from, like DuckTales, where in DuckTales there's a lot of treasure boxes that are just kind of like floating out in space. They're invisible. You just kind of had to jump everywhere and sort of randomly find that stuff. And in Shovel Knight, it's much more deliberate and thoughtful, and they do provide clues, or at least non-clues, as to where this stuff is. And if you're paying attention, you will find it. Now, whether you can actually get to it is a question of skill, but I love that. And that's something that really is missing from a lot of modern games.
And I think
such a great throwback.
When I said that the game shows the signs of having spent the right amount of time to percolate in development, I think that's a situation where it really comes out, because they're able to sort of build these levels and then go back through and say, okay, maybe we can slide a secret in here, because there are level structures where you look at it and say, oh, they found a little spot they could hide a secret in this level. They probably designed this level without that secret there and came back and added it later. And by having as much, basically they had as much time as they wanted with this game, because their Kickstarter was as successful as it was, that they were able to sit there and do all of these little perfectionist tweaks that I think really benefits the game in untold number of ways.
Mm-hmm.
The only, so I know I said earlier my biggest complaint with the game, but actually I have one other, which is I don't find the boss battles to be very engaging. Hmm. I feel like pretty much the majority of the bosses are beaten by some combination of jump down on them.
Yeah, well, that is. I think that's true for most enemy encounters. I think that's one of the weaknesses of the game. When you're doing your pogo jump, you're basically invulnerable. And like, even if you're not hurting the enemy, you're not taking damage most of the time. Or if he's wearing a spike helmet, then you're an idiot for even trying it in the first place.
Right.
But those enemies are few and far between.
I feel like that the boss battles... I haven't learned their patterns yet, which is very much a feature of games of the era it's cribbing on, is that these bosses have a pattern, you have to learn them, and then you kind of figure out an attack strategy to address them. I don't feel like I've had to do that for any of these bosses. I feel like I'm pretty much beating them on the first try by jump.
Unfortunately, I think that you're going to keep that feeling throughout, but I've started New Game Plus where you get double the damage, and also you get fewer... Actually, you don't get any restorative items in levels, and you get fewer checkpoints. So now I'm you know, that keeps me on my toes a little bit more, and I can't just, you know, absorb damage and keep swinging and keep jumping at the enemies. You really have to watch their patterns.
Yeah, but I would like for the bosses to have been a little bit more cerebral than they are, I think.
Right.
Well, I mean, Mega Man bosses aren't that cerebral either.
Well,
They have patterns, but they're not that complicated usually.
So early Mega Man bosses, no. I would say some of the later Mega Man bosses and some of the Mega Man X bosses are significantly more... There's more things going on. They have more than one attack. You have to know more than just, okay, he does this jump, then he does that jump. He does this jump, then he does that jump. You kind of have to learn what he's doing and pick up clues. And I think that's one place where this game lacks a little bit.
Before we move on to another game, I just want to say one thing that disappoints me a little bit is that all the... You do get some items that allow you to increase your mobility, you know, like you'll be able to air dash and things like that, and that's pretty cool, but they're all hidden in levels. And so what that means is that you basically never have to use them.
Right.
Except for when you're getting out of the area that you found them in the first place. And then usually they throw some other like bonus level that you can't really complete without that item.
Yeah, but the invulnerability ones the same way.
Yeah, like the ring of phasing or whatever. Like you use it in basically two places. I guess you could use it more within levels, just like trying to reduce the damage that you're taking, like just, you know, try and not cheat your way, but
I straight up used it to bypass a spike puzzle. I just said screw it.
So yeah, you can do that, but I never really felt compelled to, and so that
no.
You know, I would have liked those special items that actually are used to solve a puzzle or to increase your mobility to be just, you know, unavoidable. You just get them through regular gameplay. And
right.
Maybe...
It goes back a bit to when we had the discussion about Link Between Worlds and optional items or items that you don't necessarily know the player has them, so you can't really account for them in the level structure.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, it's exactly the same principle. So I would have liked just more of those puzzles, because at the end, like, you play with those toys for one level and then that's it. Shovel Knight has a pretty cool repertoire of moves already, but eventually kind of gets old, and it would have been nice to have more opportunities to play with those other fun things.
Maybe something in New Game Plus? Do you know, is the game just harder, or have they added additional rewards and challenges?
I haven't seen anything really... no, you don't really get any additional rewards.
It is a straight-up New Game Plus.
Yeah, where you keep the items that you found, you keep all the health, increased health and stuff like that, and you just go through the game again, but the enemies do deal more damage, and yeah, it's just harder
you're
to
just
get
on,
through.
On hard mode.
Yeah, yeah. So I will probably be using the items more just to try to get out of some encounters and things like mm-hmm. that, but that's not really what I have in mind. I just want more of, you know, the Forest of Phazing thing where you have to use the items to get
right.
through.
And that's a really cool level.
And I wonder if that might be like a vector for DLC, you know, where they could do more of these item specific challenge levels where they really require you to master certain techniques that are otherwise optional in the main game.
Right. Well, there are some Kickstarter promises that are yet to come. Like there is going to be special modes, like special challenges playing as the boss characters.
Yep.
And, oh, cool. Yeah, you're going to get fun stuff like that. That's coming up. Who knows when?
I do.
The boss designs do seem really, really cool so far.
I do think this is a game that is ripe for some form of sequel because they've already built this custom engine that runs on literally everything. Mm-hmm. So yeah. At this point, they would be fools to just go, okay, we're done.
Yeah, maybe if not a sequel, then just a different creative property that runs on the same engine and has, you know, some similarities, but is different
right.
in other ways as well.
They've done. That'd be
cool too.
They've done a lot of work to throw away this stuff. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the most exciting things about Shovel Knight is that it feels like a very complete concept.
Absolutely.
In that they've thought through all these characters and the designs of the characters and the kind of goofy world that it takes place in is original and it's cohesive and it's all you've never seen any of it before. And I think like doing a strict sequel to it would actually kind of lose some of that appeal. Like I would love for them to, you know, be original again and do something different. And it's okay if it uses the same engine. If it's okay if it plays similarly in some ways, differently in others. I think that'd be really exciting. But a straight sequel to me, like it misses some of the point. Like the cool thing about Shovel Knight is that it's not Mega Man. It's not DuckTales.
Let me ask you a question, Johnny. If this game, you say it's a very complete package, and I agree. Let's say the 3DS version of this game came out on a cartridge in 2010. So 3DS has been out for 6 months.
It would have been like Henry Hatsworth, you know.
I mean, I was thinking
sung
Shinobi.
The praises of that game to you know, to the ends of the earth. And
I think
of the same reasons, you know.
I think this would have been very approachable at the same level like the Shinobi 3DS game was. I think ultimately this game, it's complete in the way that it hinges on almost, you know, full retail level of game. It is a tremendous value for what you are getting.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the biggest release in the last couple weeks, at least for Wii U
I mean,
and 3DS.
For Wii U, maybe one of the biggest games of the year. And you know, Neil has already said it's his favorite game of the year so far. I've heard other people say that as well. And I don't know if I'll feel that strongly by the time I play more of it. But I can even from the early part, I can see why people would feel that way. It is pretty fantastic.
It's fantastic. I don't feel that strongly. Just for the record.
Well, I mean, it's still early. I don't know what the rest of the games this year will feel like. I've had a lot of fun with it. Like I said, I've got some issues, but we'll see.
Okay, so I'll go next, and I will try to be brief. I have not played a ton of this game, but I want to talk about it because I know a lot of our listeners have strong feelings about it, or maybe you're just curious about The Wonderful 101. I haven't played it since last year's E3 demo, which was a lot like the previous year's E3 demo in that it confused the hell out of me. And that's pretty much how I felt the first hour at least of playing the retail game, which I got when it was on sale on the eShop a couple months ago. And I finally put it in and played it, and I have seen the videos. Thank you, everyone, for the links. I have seen the videos about sort of mastering the mechanics of the game, and I've got a GameFAQs file open and ready every time I play it because this game really poorly explains itself.
It's a perfect example of maybe it's not a good idea to move everything, like every info, to the gamepad, because when you're playing, you're looking at the TV, you might not even realize that there's a tutorial going on the gamepad. That's what this game does. It's ridiculous. I played most of the game forgetting that you could even use items. I forgot they were a thing in this game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this game has a lot of layers that you might not discover. And frankly, I think I'm aware of most of them, and I've been reading up on it. I'm trying to give myself the best possible experience playing the game, and also I'm going in with a lot of caveats in my head of I need to be patient, I need to respect the challenge of the game and expect it to be difficult and demanding and pay attention to it, and I need to not get too frustrated if it doesn't all work the first time I try it. And even then, the game is getting on my nerves pretty much every time I play it. There's a lot to like about it. I mean, it's very beautiful. I think the writing's really funny, and I think the music and the graphics, the artwork, and the writing, the story all really come together, and it really does feel like a Saturday morning cartoon. It has that vibe. It's very exuberant and pretty and very frantic, and I love that aspect of it. And I totally see what they were going for with the concept. It's just the game is fucking frustrating. It's very confusing to play. Even when you know what to do, it's so visually busy that it's hard to tell what's going on a lot of the time. A lot of the enemy attacks are very difficult to see when they're coming because the enemies move in this certain way, or the camera is in a terrible position sometimes. A lot of times I'm not sure even, like, the levels are very linear, but a lot of times I can't even tell which way I'm supposed to go to proceed because the camera is so bad. And then, you know, like a lot of platinum games, a lot of Japanese games, a lot of these character action games, which is what it is, the game also has a lot of sort of like action cutscene type events, you know. I mean, they're not strictly quick time events, but they're parts of the level in which you're not just like moving left to right and attacking enemies as you come. It's more like you're on this thing that's flying through the air and you're fighting for a while, but then something's going to explode and you have to jump at just the right moment to get away from it, to get to the next platform. And It expects you to do these things very, very quickly with almost no warning. And it's set up really, I think, to make you fail a few times until you kind of catch on to what it's doing. But in the process, it's really just kind of annoying. Like, there's something about it that I find very difficult to be patient with, and I'm trying to force myself to be patient. But it's happened a number of times, even in the first 2 or 3 hours of playing the game, where I feel like the game's very unfair, and I'm playing on easy, and it's still hard. But a lot of the difficulty is not from the difficulty of the combat. A lot of it is because the levels are pieced together in a very strange way that's just not very clear to the player. And the action proceeds in a kind of a very like zigzaggy, unpredictable fashion, which it holds up the aesthetic of the Saturday morning cartoon in that it feels kind of very cut up and you know, it feels like you're just jumping from one crazy moment to the next. But the problem is, as you're doing that, the game design sort of expects you to keep up and understand the flow of what's happening, but you don't. And when you don't keep up with it, it punishes you for that with failure. And I find that sort of like really unpleasant. But there are aspects of the game I like quite a bit. And I do feel that I'm getting better at it. I'm getting better at the combat. I'm starting to anticipate the bullshit moments that I know are going to come because I've seen their ilk before. So I feel like I'm going to kind of get used to the craziness of it, and maybe it will stop bothering me so much as I get later in the game. But for now, I'd say it's a very mixed experience. I mean, there's very high highs and very low lows with the Wonderful 101, and it is hard to get into, for sure.
Yeah, it's been a while since I played it. It's one of those games that I kind of stopped playing halfway through. I kind of remember enjoying it, but it just, I don't know, I saw something shinier. But yeah, I can't dispute the fact that the game is really at its best when you're learning how to fight enemies, like underground. So I gotta block this enemy attack, and then I can counterattack. And, you know, when you manage to do it successfully, it's very satisfying. And then, I gotta fight two of these dudes at the same time, and then, that completely changes my strategy. That's really cool. But then there's these moments where, now there's like this giant missile coming at you in slow-mo, and you gotta create a punch and punch it out of the air, and it's, you know, like, yeah, those cutscenes are garbage.
Yeah,
like, I didn't like it. I didn't like it in, like, I don't know, Resident Evil 4, I guess, maybe. Had those, like, I'd run the boulder moment and things like that. It wasn't good then, it isn't good now. Like, instead of just pressing a button this time, it's, well, create this shape. And, you know, right. That doesn't make it any better.
To me, the stuff in RE4 was okay because, you know, at the time it was refreshing in that they were trying to keep you engaged with the cutscenes so that you wouldn't just set the controller down and walk away.
How about making good cutscenes to keep you engaged?
Yeah, but the things that they were asking you to do were simple. It wasn't hard to complete those cutscenes as long as you – they just kept you kind of tense because you never knew when one was going to come up. But if it came up, you were probably going to pass. And the problem with Wonderful 101 is even sometimes on the second, third, fourth attempts, I know it's coming and I still can't do it correctly. That is bad. That's bad design. But you're right. I mean, when you're kind of doing this sort of base gameplay where you're just fighting dudes and you're just collecting things and you're making the different shapes – that stuff is fun, you know, but there's a lot more to the game, which might seem like a good quality, but in fact, it feels very disruptive. It feels like I'm being interrupted a lot of times. And sometimes when I'm interrupted, it throws me back into the game at a very unexpected time when I'm not really ready to handle whatever's about to happen. And I think if you've played the game, you'll know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, well, I mean, I'd say it is certainly a curiosity, and it's very lovingly made. There's a lot of care and detail put into it, but also there's just a lot of thing, a lot of choices made in this game, a lot of directions that it goes in that to me seem very ill-advised. It seems like someone had it in their head, I really want to do this, and maybe it was Kamiya, and the people around him just didn't have the courage to stand up and say, no, you shouldn't. That's not good, man. Let's try something different. Let's iterate on this until we find something that works better than what you have in your mind. I don't know. Maybe I'm projecting, and that's not actually how it went down. But it's very artistic. I mean, there's a grand vision here, but it's messy. It's a very messy game. So I don't know. It's quite interesting, and I'm going to keep playing it. But you know, so far I'd say it's a very uneven experience going through it for sure. All right. Well, let's wrap up new business with a few more Tomodachi thoughts from Mr. Guillaume.
Sure. I'm still playing Tomodachi Life. I've seen a lot of people on Twitter kind of getting, you know, tired of the repetition and giving up on the game. And I understand. I'm seeing a lot of repetition as well. And I think mostly why I'm still enjoying it is because I'm not, you know, playing it alone. The one thing I want to touch on, and that's really, really cool, is the Street Pass use in the game. And I kind of understand, you know, like Johnny, you ranted that, oh, why was this locked? Like, why was the Street Pass locked, at the beginning of the game? Like, it doesn't make any sense, but it starts to make sense when you realize that, probably the best feature, of Street Pass is that once your a couple of Miis on your island get kids, at some point, like, you see them grow up, like, they grow up freakishly fast, like, they're, like, the alien and the alien movies, but, anyway, so, after maybe a week, they're, you know, all grown up and ready to either, you can choose to send them to other islands, i.e. to send them through Street Pass, and then you're basically, like, they're never gonna come back again, they're just gonna be, you know, traveling from 3DS to 3DS. Or you can keep them on your island and, you know, they'll, you know, take an apartment and they'll be just like any other Mii in the game. So of course, to keep with the kind of scenario that my child is unloved and unwanted, I send him off to travel. And, one of those Miis that I sent out is kind of basically stuck between my 3DS and, Karen's 3DS. Like, we just keep street passing it back and forth, and he hasn't been able to escape that hell. But another Mii has been more fortunate, and I street pass with someone.
She gets them every other weekend, right?
Yeah, something like that. But yeah, so like another Mii that I sent out has been more fortunate. I sent him to, you know, a complete stranger, and I never really expected to hear back from it, except that I got a postcard through Spot Pass. And that's pretty cool because you basically get like, you know, like he's talking about how, you know, this new island always smells like pancake for some reason and blah, blah, blah. I made some new friends. I'm now at this level because they've been so nice to me. And here's a picture of me and, I don't know, Wazazu or whatever, like whoever this person is. And So yeah, like you get like some sort of snippet of where they are, like the island they are and what's happening to them. It's not a whole lot of info and you don't get any personal information, of course. But I thought that it's really cool that you get this through SpotPass. I mean, it's never been, I don't think, like there's nothing technically to prevent it. Nintendo could always have done this, but I always imagine, because they've never done it, that they, someone at, you know, was afraid of using this feature, was a, you know, prevented it from happening. But no, like, it's actually something that Nintendo teams are allowed to do. And I don't understand why they don't do that in more, on more of their games. I mean, recently I've played through Kirby. There are several kind of leaderboards for various modes in the game, but you fill up those leaderboards only through Street Pass. And if you Street Pass a person once with a game, then you're going to get their results for the time, you know, at the moment that you Street Pass them. And unless you Street Pass them again, you're never going to get an update. Like, I mean, you can try to beat their times, but then, so what? Like, they'll never...
New Super Mario 2 was that way as well.
Exactly, yeah. Like, okay, so you can beat their score, but they'll never know. And it's like you can...
It really should record them as an acquaintance and then let you keep up with their progress after the fact through SpotPass.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I think it's a cool feature. They should have done that a long time ago, but I'm glad to see that it's happening in Tomodachi Life in some way. I mean, it's not a high score, but it's pretty cool that, okay, so now you sent off your Mii to travel. Now what? Well, you still get news from it.
Yeah, that's really cool. That it, like when you talked about, when you just described that, it made me think of Fraggle Rock, how there was that one Fraggle who was always on the expedition to the human world and was sending back these letters about all the strange things he was discovering. That's a cool idea, right? You know? It's like this weird connection to the outside, and you send this emissary who, and it makes sense to do it with the children of the Miis because that's not a real person. So you, that way you don't lose the people who you work to import into the game. You know, it's more this strange amalgam of them. And, it's a nice idea to kind of send them out onto the world and let them discover it. And like, to me, I get a little bit skeptical about like how much of that stuff is just pre-written. You know, is it really even the other person's 3DS communicating with SpotPass and then that message getting to you? Or is it more that Nintendo's servers know that you have sent something off to StreetPass, so now the server itself is just generating these messages and you're downloading
them? Well, no, actually it is. Like, each island kind of has its own address. Like you name your island, so it will have the name of the island, but then we'll have like Tomato Soup Ocean or whatever, and some sort of number. So they've all got this kind of ID. So you're getting the ID of the island that the Mii is on. And also, I did receive a SpotPass update of the Mii that I sent to Karen's 3DS. So that's how I know it's real. Like, we basically share the same Miis, and so I got a postcard, like, the Mii was telling me, oh, I've met this really cool person, and it's like, it's the clone of who I have on my island.
Oh, okay.
So,
that's
cool.
Yeah,
so it's all actual stuff from an actual person's 3DS. And I guess the only way that those Miis that you send out could run into a wall is if the person doesn't have access to, somehow, like, doesn't have access to Wi-Fi, or doesn't have it enabled, or didn't enable SpotPass, or maybe deactivated Street Pass after getting a couple. Who knows? But still, it's really cool.
I mean, most people will eventually encounter a Nintendo Zone at an airport or something.
Right.
So presumably, even if they don't normally have Wi-Fi at home that they're connected to, they'll encounter an opportunity to upload that stuff, even if they don't intend to. Mm-hmm. That's really cool, man. You guys are like a perfect case study to test out these weird features in Tomodachi. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we've got a whole bunch of listener mail, and we're going to get through as much as we possibly can, so stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We have a review of Shovel Knight for Wii U by Zach Miller. You might not have noticed the release of lately reported Shovel Knight, but while we may not have spent much time on the game, Zach thinks you should if you enjoy classic games ranging from Zelda 2 to Castlevania 4, because you know Zach loves Castlevania, then you'll really dig this game.
John, that's a terrible pun, and you should feel ashamed.
I have no shame. We also have a video. E3 videos on the Nintendo World Report by Jared Rosenberg. E3 may have wrapped up a couple of weeks ago, but Jared is still uploading hot videos, too hot for release, until after the buzz has chilled. Come overheat. Come overheat on E3 content all over again with video of Captain Toad, Treasure Tracker, Splatoon, Smash Brothers 3DS and Wii U, Kirby and the Rainbow Curse, Project Guard, Project Giant Robot, Mario Maker, and most important to me, Just Dance 2015.
You're an asshole, James.
No, I'm an artist.
Whoa. We have a feature. Top 8 Mario Kart 8 tracks by NWR staff. Did you wake up in a cold sweat last night wondering which MK8 tracks should earn your love? Did John name your favorite track in the last segment, leading you to doubt your choices? We got you covered. 8 tracks numbered 1 to 8. NWR, we decide your favorites for you. And we have a review. Pokemon Art Academy on 3DS in Europe.
Yeah, the game's not coming out here for a while.
Mm-hmm. By Dan Koopman. I once got in an argument that Nintendo could, and will, put the Pokemon license on any game they can. I walked away when my intemperate opponent said, "Oh yeah? Well, where's your Pokemon Art Academy?" Well, friend, here's Pokemon Art Academy. And, you jerk, Dan really likes drawing Diglett.
Diglett.
Drawing Diglett, by the way, is like 3 strokes. It's a hump and 2 eyes, and you're done.
Nice.
Next up, we have an interview with Armillo's Yanni Fisa of Fuzzy Wuzzy Games. Fuzzy Wuzzy Games, that's the name of a game developer.
It is.
After a long journey that started with Wii U eShop game Armillo as an XBLA game and ended with it as a highly anticipated release on the eShop, we sat down with Yanni Fisa to talk about the game and developing a game with just a few people in a basement. Video included. I've heard very good things about Armillo.
Yeah.
And next up, we have an editorial called "Is Amiibo Nintendo's Next E-Reader?" by Neil Ronahan. Answer, no. Well, that's probably not fair. Neil is concerned that Nintendo isn't as bought into the figures as video game accessories as Disney and Activision, while simultaneously interested in this difference in philosophy. And yes, it, like the E-Reader, is not required. But man, E-Reader was cards. These are way more expensive figures.
It's true. We also have another interview from E3 on Story of Seasons by Yoshifumi Hashimoto, by Becky, Kim, and Clay. Do you want to know more about this year's iteration of the Bokujo Monogatari series from a man who worked on both them and Rune Factory? Do you know what the Bokujo Monogatari is? It's all very confusing. So during E3, we turn to Marvelous AQL's head of development to make sense of it all. Lastly this week, we have an editorial. Is Open World Enough for Zelda? By Aaron Edwards. Following Nintendo's tease of the next entry in the Zelda franchise, the offer of an, quote, open-world Zelda game has created quite a lot of buzz. Aaron is concerned that just being open-world may not be enough. However, he speaks glowingly of Metroid Prime and DK64, so you can read it yourself.
Of course, you can read all of this and lots more over at our website, which you should be checking every day for the rest of your life. It's at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. By the way, we had Now Playing this week, but last week we didn't do a Now Playing, and the little recording that you heard during the break was obtained by some friends of ours at E3, some fellow staff members who got that plug for RFN from the Charles Martinet speaking in Luigi's voice, and I think a little bit of Mario at the end. So we'll play it
again. I thought they had run into Mario and Luigi.
They were not, the brothers themselves were not available for comment, but their good friend Charles Martinet was on hand, and we thank Charles for doing that for us. It was awesome. He's a super nice guy we've run into many times over the years, and he's always incredibly friendly and helpful.
Yeah,
and
fun to hear. I want to say that story we heard on the show is that he just really loves his job. Like
he seems to.
He wasn't hired by Nintendo to show up at E3 this year. He just sort of did because he enjoys it.
Yeah, I think he likes meeting fans. He likes doing the voices. He likes being recognized as that guy who does those voices, and E3 is the perfect place for it. So we thank Charles, and thanks to our friends on the staff who got that for us. Anyway, we'll play it again sometime so you can hear it with fresh ears. But for right now, we're going to jump into listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. A great many of you have been using that email address, and we've gotten a lot of emails. We're not going to catch up on all of them today, but we picked out a pretty big selection. Depending on how these go, we might get through a bunch of them. We'll see. But James is going to read the first one.
Steven writes, I'm sure I'm not alone in saying I was blown away by Nintendo's performance at E3. The digital event was fun and had lots of reveals, but even more impressive were the hours and hours of Treehouse coverage the following days. We got to see all of the new games being played on real hardware. No bait and switch with Nintendo. The only gripes I had about the whole experience were Miyamoto's, quote, IPs. That was some of the ugliest, most uninspired shit I've seen, and I hope these tech demos get left on the shelf. Maybe Miyamoto needs to hang it up. My final complaint would be the oversaturation of Smash Brothers. I've had more than enough of my fail of that game. Having the just one more thing part of the digital event be the announcement of Palutena was so anticlimactic. Anyway, I wouldn't be shocked if we see Microsoft and Sony take Nintendo's lead yet again and start airing a well-produced pre-recorded conferences. They've revolutionized the E3 experience while simultaneously removing the need for coverage. Sorry, anyone who attended, we don't need you anymore.
Oh, Steven.
There's a lot to get into.
Yeah,
here.
Like on one level, I wonder if this might be a joke email. It's hard to tell. There's so many strange aspects to it.
So here's the thing. I don't think this is a joke email. I think some of the things may have been said slightly in jest. I think he's
legitimate.
I think he's legitimately. I don't want to say put off, but concerned about what he saw with the projects. Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to know, I don't think Nintendo did a great job of this, even though they called them Project Whatever.
Yeah, they didn't present them that well. And,
yeah, is that these aren't games. These are concepts mm-hmm. that they've built essentially a model that gives you something visual to represent as you test out these play concepts. So who was it over at Argonaut that had said that they've seen these demos Nintendo's put together? No, it wasn't Argonaut. It was
Argonaut.
No.
Company doesn't.
Oh,
exist
you think
anymore.
I don't think. Was it Cuthbert that said it?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, but he'd spoken about these. You know, they'd come to Nintendo with an idea, and they go, "Oh no, we made a sort of a mock up of that gameplay concept years ago, and we didn't like it. And here's why." This is the first time in a while Nintendo has come out with these pieces of. But essentially are the gameplay equivalent of concept art. They're sort of like the skeleton of a gameplay concept that they've wrapped some relatively small amount of investment on just so you can sort of get a feel for how this would work in a larger structure of a game. Project Guard and Project Giant Robot graphically, yes, look really, really poor compared to other stuff on the floor, but that's because they didn't spend a lot of time making them look nice.
Right.
They're just straight up tech demos.
I mean, I think it's telling that these were not really shown in the digital event.
Right.
They weren't showcased. And that's because just from a visual standpoint, you don't get what they're trying to do with these. And that's not the proper way to demonstrate these. I think it's really to their detriment that they were shown on the stage event with the Treehouse. Because again, even though you have people there playing it and explaining it as they do, these are experiences that you really need to play for yourself to appreciate. And I think some people maybe can project themselves into the experience of playing it, and some people have a harder time with that. And, you know, it's not something because they're gameplay experiments. So they don't necessarily play like anything that you have experience with. So it's going to be a challenge for you to kind of wrap your head around it. And it's not something that's intuitive just from looking at a video of it. You're not really going to see immediately why it might be fun, what's interesting about it, what's challenging about the gameplay that they present, and what the possibilities are. And it's one thing to have someone try to discuss that, but again, it's difficult for them as well because it's not a complete game. It is not
right.
It is not polished in the way that all the other demos at E3 were for Nintendo.
So usually they would show these to the press but not have any footage of it? Like, because I've heard a lot about like that Cat Pogo kind of demo.
I mean, that's what they did with Star Fox effectively. And I think the reason they did that with Star Fox is because that is wrapped around a brand people have some admiration for. And if they saw this very rough looking thing that the gameplay really isn't ironed out yet, it may really dampen their enthusiasm for what will eventually be a future game.
Right. And in the case of Star Fox, I think that game is even earlier than Project Garden and a Project Giant Robot and, right. and even more rudimentary. But on the same level, Star Fox is something that does exist and that people are familiar with. So as long as they just say, we're making Star Fox, you already have a much better idea of what that could turn out to be
right.
than you do for these other things. Now, I will say the solution to this problem for Nintendo is exactly what Steven dismisses at the end of his email, which is that this is a case where you really need the media to help translate the experience of being there and getting to play it yourself and transmute that to the listeners in language that they can understand, that doesn't sound like developer speak and doesn't rely entirely on moving images or something like that. And I hope that Steven will go and, for instance, I wrote a pretty long article hands-on preview of Project Guard, okay? Not my favorite thing at Nintendo's booth, but it was interesting. I had fun. I played it multiple times. I would love to play it again. I would love to see what else they're going to do with that concept. And if you don't get the appeal of Project Guard, I hope you'll go read what I wrote, because I think there's a chance, if I did my job right, and after 15 years, I have some level of skill at this, I hope that I'm able to explain what I experienced and what was fun about it and what are the potential issues, but also the potentially really exciting things about that experience. And that's something that for certain games and certain demos like this one, I don't think you're going to get just from watching a video or even just from watching another person play it. It needs to be explained to you. That's my job.
We both played both of those projects. I mean, I played each one twice. I think you might have played some of them even more than that. I think the experience of the first time I played those, just not having no concept of what I was doing, because it was hard to sort of, you know, compartmentalize this into experiences I've had. I think watching other people play it in person, having had that hands-on time, really helped me formulate what this thing is. So Project Giant Robot really isn't about, oh, you can move the gamepad a bit to get some stuff and you press the buttons move. It's really more about moving your body. That game is really about you trying to keep the gamepad with yourself to sort of force you to try to maintain balance and do
to
these.
To me, that game could be part of Wii Fit.
Yeah, it could be part of a lot of things. I mean, it you could make it its own thing, like an eShop game. But I mean, it is a game where they want you to move a lot. And when I first played it, I was just trying to move it around with my hands. It wasn't until I had that experience and then saw somebody play it, and I could sort of take what I was seeing and, you know, put it in the context of what I had played, that it made sense. That, oh, I see, I'm not supposed to just stand still and use the shoulder buttons and then kind of lean the gamepad. I'm supposed to move my whole body to try to maintain balance.
And to be fair, the speed and the clunkiness of it is related to that. It is to help translate your motions into what you see on the screen without breaking the connection. So when you lean forward, your body has a weight to it that the controller alone does not.
Right.
And so that's conveyed in the game by that robot leaning forward slowly because he's pushing against the weight of his opponent, right? So you're supposed to feel like, you know, you can't lean all the way over. Like, you're not going to, like, crunch down on the floor just to win at this game. You need to fight your own resistance against gravity, and that becomes part of playing the game.
Yeah.
That's why I say whether or not it ever uses the balance board or whatever, it feels like something that could be in Wii Fit, because it's a simple game. But a lot of the fun of it is in moving your body, kind of like doing the hula hoop thing in Wii Fit. And I thought it was an interesting concept. It does not feel like anything Miyamoto has ever made.
No, it does not.
In my opinion.
So I think was gonna say, I think
and it's really funny. Like, I think it would be a great party game. To me, the scary thing about Project Giant Robot is that, you know, so far they're still not talking about games that use two game pads. And that game, because it is a one-on-one sort of wrestling game with these giant robots, is ideally suited to play one-on-one locally. And I don't think you have to have a gamepad in order to pull that off, but it's supposed to be designed with that in mind. It's supposed to leverage the gamepad. That game, I don't know how much there is really to it as a single-player game.
I do think when we speak about having to sort of play these games to understand them better, I think you can extrapolate that to the people showing those games. So I know you and I both saw these games on day one. Yep. I saw them again on day three when I brought two people I knew who went to DigiPen. They graduated DigiPen. They're working in the industry right now. I took them over to those games because it's the kind of weird experimental stuff that may come up when you're at a university about making video games.
Oh, yeah.
And what I observed is that the way that the people who were showing those games were showing them had completely evolved in the 3 days that it happened. And that never happens in an E3 booth. You show the game the same way every time. That is your singular job. For Project Guard, they had like gone to Radio Shack and gotten a PA system where they were just like screaming out the numbers of the targets you had to jump to or the cameras, because they realized that on the first day, while people may be calling out numbers, it really wasn't getting through to the person playing it. So they just made it so deafeningly loud that you had to respond to it. And that made the game – that let you experience what the real concept of the game is. The concept isn't, oh, I get to tap on the gamepad to go jump to place. The concept is they're trying to overload you with information and you're relying on other people to sort of sort it out for you. That's what that game is. And that's an experience you can't have watching someone play it, because ultimately you're neither the player with the gamepad or effectively the people behind the player who are also playing the game along with them.
So sometimes when they show these concepts, like they take a lot of time before they actually become actual games. Like I know that you guys keep talking about
years
the
and years
DS,
and years.
Yeah, the DS demo of basically what would become Steel Diver. But the fact that they showed this now, does this kind of mean that perhaps like it's more imminent? Like they're looking to make something now, or are we going to see that in like the successor of the Wii U? Or
I think their own conversation around those games. It was never a, hey, this is a game we're making right now. It was, these are concepts that Mr. Miyamoto, and I always refer to him as Mr. Miyamoto, is playing with. You know, to show ways that you can use the gamepad in unique and creative ways. I don't know that any of the people I spoke to about those games ever said, these are games that are coming out. They always spoke about them as sort of like, he wanted to share with you the kind of experiments they're doing.
Yeah.
That he made the decision to show these games because he wants people to know that, yes, we do know that this gamepad can do things and it's just not being tapped into. And we are trying to find ways to make that engaging and experience for the player.
Yeah, I mean,
but that doesn't mean that in two consoles from now, like the Nintendo console that requires a full bodysuit won't have a Project Robo.
No, I mean, I'm not saying we won't see Project Giant Robot shelved for years.
I mean, they'll think they'll have a whole game wrapped around something, and if they just don't like it, they'll just put it on the shelf and use it two consoles later. You know?
Yeah, I mean, they spoke about that with Luigi's Mansion.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the 3D Luigi's Mansion, where ultimately it became a 3DS game. Because they're like,
that was originally a GameCube game that they were testing with a 3D display adapter,
yeah,
something like that.
Yep. Yeah. And they said, this is a cool idea, we don't really have any technology that can use it. And then, you know, way down the road, like 10 years later, like, actually now we do have a technology that can use it.
So let me throw out one possibility, which is that Miyamoto might have a dozen more gamepad concepts like the two that
I'm sure he does
at E3, and maybe these aren't even the best two that he's got going. Maybe they're not even the most promising. Maybe the other ones are starting to gel together into a game that it's not one game yet, but he has an idea for pulling that stuff together. Kind of like with Skyward Sword. You know, there were a lot of Wii Motion Plus concepts that kind of were pulled together that an experience.
Wii Sport Resort is basically just the prelude to that game.
Some of that, yeah. And some of the stuff in Resort is like, this is kind of weird to be in. Like the sword fighting. Why is this in a sports game? But
or the fact that they went back to bowling. It's like, why are we doing bowling again? Oh, because you're going to bowl with bombs in Skyward Sword.
Exactly. Because they got it working and they thought it made a difference, and bowling was super popular at the time.
Sure.
But my point being, maybe Guard and Giant Robot were just the two concepts he had that the graphics were the best. You know, maybe the other ones were a lot simpler just weren't as ready to show. Maybe they were two that he thought would be kind of more engaging with the live audience that you get at E3.
Yeah.
Whereas some of the other ones might be better suited for solo play, but those don't take advantage of the venue as much. And so maybe he wanted to hold those back, use them in Star Fox or a different game, or maybe develop a new franchise.
It's really that. Those two games attract a crowd.
Yeah. And my point being that I don't think calling these two demos that were at E3 new IPs, I don't think that's accurate.
I mean, they're literally not IPs. There is no IP.
There's not really any intellectual property to speak of in these things. They are concepts. They are literally tech demos. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, that is not a pejorative term here. Tech demo is they are showing off the technology of the gamepad, and they're trying to show some of the cool things you can do with it that really, I mean, it's not new technology, but they're using it in a different way that hasn't been done before. And they're trying to suss out, what are people interested in? What are people excited about?
Right.
What is the most fun? What holds up to the test of time? What kind of different concepts can gel together? What can we use in our existing franchises? What can we build a new franchise around? Sure. This is the process that Nintendo goes through all the time on all their systems, and we rarely get a peek into it. And that's why I like these things being at E3, because to me, it's just really interesting to kind of peek behind the curtain a little bit and get a sense of the kind of like prototyping creative culture that they have all the time, but we rarely get a glimpse of.
I think the idea that you've put out here, that maybe these are the ones that they know aren't going to be the game. These are the ones that were more engaging, you know, for a crowd. There's a certain sort of Nintendo-esque logic there of, we're not going to show the ones that we think we're actually going to make a game out of, because we want to sort of blow you away when we have a real game based around them.
Right.
We don't want people to associate the final game we end up making with this tech demo. We want that to be its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to sit on these. We've got these really cool ones that look really fun, so we're going to show those.
Yeah, and especially the fact that Miyamoto was trying to farm out Star Fox to an outside developer. To me, that's kind of unfortunate. Because it's been a very long time. It's been since, what, 97, since Nintendo made a Star Fox game internally. But I would expect the reason for that is because he wants to get it out soon. Yeah. He wants it to be on the Wii U and not the next platform. And Nintendo's own, their existing studios are probably just all booked up because it takes so many people to make these HD games. And
I would imagine they're looking to do this the same way that Nintendo/Sora Limited has been working with Bamco to get Smash Brothers done. We need more bodies than we have to produce this game with our other stuff going on. So we'll put our producer on the game, but we'll bring in an outside studio to fill the seats. Since we're on Smash Brothers, and you know, he mentions that this Nintendo may have gone a little Smash Brothers crazy during their E3 coverage. And I would say that from the outside looking in, I mean, I love Smash Brothers, but I'm not a huge Smash Brothers person. I understand the mentality there. I feel like in the actual booth itself, I feel like it needed as much space as it got, but I do think it crowded out some other stuff that could have used some additional space. I think, you know, we talked about it last week, just trying to get on things like Zelda or on Hyrule Warriors became a real chore at some point, because people, once they were done with Smash Brothers, only had really two units to play with. And I think that's sort of a nice parallel for what they kind of did in their coverage. I think ultimately they did a good job of talking about a lot of games. But, and while I can see if Smash Brothers isn't really your thing, feeling like, okay, more Smash Brothers. Great, more Smash Brothers. Okay, some more Smash Brothers. For them, this is, after Mario Kart, this is their big thing this year. This is what they need to sell Wii U consoles.
It's the most commercial property that they have coming up, especially right. for Wii U. And the other aspect of Smash Brothers that is, you can look at it in two different ways. Smash Brothers appeals to people in different ways and on a lot of different levels, and that's something we've discussed in recent weeks. But to me, one of the cool things about Smash Brothers is that even though it's a very specific kind of game, it's not even just a fighting game. It's like a really exotic form of fighting games. And I understand not everybody will like it, but the other big aspect of Smash Brothers is that it is this glorious showcase for all these characters and different games and different franchises that you know, even games that Nintendo doesn't even make themselves, right? So there's something very appealing, like there's something very mainstream about it because every person on the planet is going to recognize at least a couple of the characters that are in this game. Mm-hmm. And no other game series or company can provide that. So putting Smash Brothers out as the front-facing display of your booth and of your entire presence at the show is really smart because there's something in Smash Brothers for everybody. And that pulls people in to, they want it, even if they don't like Smash Brothers, even if they've never enjoyed the previous games, they're probably going to at least try it because at least they want to see how Mega Man plays.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So we talked about this when we were discussing the roundtables last week. Nintendo's put up these hyper abbreviated versions of the roundtables on the Wii U eShop video section. And I was watching the Sakurai one again.
Do we show up in any of them?
No, we don't. They're super cut down.
Mm, that's too bad.
And they cut down your awesome question about networking. Dude, that question doesn't show up. But one of the parts they do leave in is where he talks about how this is the first game where you will get to see Sonic, Mario, Mega Man, and Pac-Man all in the same place.
Yeah.
And they took an hour-long event and condensed it to 5 minutes. And that they spent a significant amount of time on him discussing that point.
It's the living museum of video games. And that's why it's a fantastic choice for Nintendo to put it so front and center and to focus so much on it. Because it has the widest appeal of anything that they make, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would say so. It also shows really well, and hell, it's almost done. You know?
That's another big part. A, it shows really well, and B, like John says, it's freaking close to
it. One of the most expansive demos I've ever played at E3.
Oh yeah. I mean it's basically the N64 game. Yeah,
the guys on IGN's Nintendo voice chat were saying that, like, one of the guys was saying, I would pay $60 for that demo. And, like, I think he might be onto something. Like that, you could play that demo for many, 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 many hours without getting sick of it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's an incredible demo. I mean, I think the game's going to be fantastic too, but just as E3 demos go, they don't get much better than that Smash Brothers demo.
No, I mean, that was basically a full game.
It's a massive deal for Nintendo, and it's okay if you're not interested and you never play it, but Nintendo's going to spend – I thought they spent exactly the right amount of attention on Smash Brothers, and I think they were very smart to do so, and I think it's going to pay off for them.
Cool.
Yeah, but as for Nintendo removing any need for media coverage of E3, I think that's a fantastically flawed premise.
Yeah, I don't think they want to do that either. I think they wanted to make sure that their talking points got out there.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the Treehouse stuff does feed back into the general media.
Yeah, the whole point of everything Nintendo does at E3 is all they can do is prevent facts. The Treehouse stage show, the Nintendo Digital event, or Nintendo Direct last year, even the demos, they are wonderful ways for Nintendo to present a very large amount of very dense factual information. And I'm glad that everyone has greater access to that than in the past. But they're also going to try to spin it in some cases. I don't think they've been very egregious about this, but you could see it going that way. And some companies are really bad about trying to spin those facts. But if you want to know what this stuff actually means, if you want to know, are the games actually fun? Nintendo can't tell you that, and if they tell you that, you can't trust them. You need independent voices.
Unless they tell you they're not fun, then...
Then maybe you can trust that, yeah. But you need people
God,
there.
God, this game is shit. What's wrong with us?
Who can say, yeah, actually, they're not
crazy. Why did we pay Tomonobu to make a game for us? What were we thinking?
So
just think back of the old Nintendo Power back in the days when Nintendo was paying for everything, and the... like, you wouldn't trust... No one read that for the reviews. No one was reading the opinions.
I would say that even though I referred to it as the party press, there was a remarkable amount of editorial discretion by the editorial staff.
It depends on the year if we're talking about Nintendo.
Yeah, it depends on the year.
But this is straight being run by Nintendo's PR team. So, I mean, that's a whole different monster.
Yeah, I want people to understand that, like, that Treehouse stage show, you know, it was really fantastically done. And a lot of those people that you saw up on the stage, we've known for a long time. We have very good relationships with. They're super nice, super smart people. They're excellent at their jobs. But those people are not the media. Those people are marketing.
Yeah.
Treehouse
Kit Ellis is straight up PR.
Yep.
Literally that is his job. Marketing branch of Nintendo of America.
They're trying to sell you something. Don't mistake it.
And that is their job. It is their right to do that, and they should do that. But you need to understand the value of having someone there to check what they do and say, yes, that's true, or no, it's actually not as fun as they make it sound, and here's why. And to look at all the details that they don't cover and to process the opinions of that stuff and to provide you with a range of opinions. You don't have to take anything we say for granted, but at least you can compare what different people say and maybe build up a consensus. You can't get a consensus from Nintendo directly.
And it's our job to ask questions they don't want to talk about.
Exactly. Like and online they may or may play. Not answer, but at least someone's there representing your interests. You know, I said this on the NeoGAF thread, but if that Sakurai roundtable talking about Smash Brothers, if I had not asked a question about online performance and whether it'll be better than Brawl, Nintendo would not have said the word online a single time talking about Smash Brothers at E3.
No.
Because they know that game, that series has a bad reputation online, and they know they have a lot of work to do to repair it, and they're not ready to talk about what they're doing yet. And you know what? They didn't really answer my question, and that's too bad. But at least I was there to ask it, and I asked that because I knew that I could not be the only person interested in that and who really wants some reassurance from those guys that they're taking the problem seriously and they're trying to do something different and better than they did last time. And I hope that most people listening to this and who, you know, even know that the roundtable exists, I hope that those people appreciate that there's at least a sliver of an opportunity at E3 every year for us to get to interact with these developers and try to get these pieces of information from them that they otherwise are not going to give us.
The role of the media in this industry is changing. It's not about just like, oh, here's some video of me playing the game. It's really much more of, you know, to do research, to find answers to questions that aren't being answered up front, or to fact check what is being presented.
Sure.
To come back to you and say, I know you couldn't see this. This is what we saw. Let me try to put it in context for you. It's not just fact, 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 fact.
Right.
It's
investigate is probably too strong of a word.
Well,
but I've always considered myself as a representative of the people at home. And frankly, a group like Nintendo World Report is much better positioned to be your representative than the professional websites, because we're there out of our own self-interest. In other words, we pay our own way to go to E3. We're doing it because we love it. I mean, I, you know, took, you know, a whole week of vacation time to go do this that I could have used for other things, because not just because I want to go play the games, it's because I want to go there and provide a service for people. And I just, it really chaps my ass when people suggest that we really don't have any purpose in showing up there, because I've been doing this for a long time and I do it in part because I love doing it. And there's a lot of benefits that I get, sure. But also I do it in part because I do the stuff at E3 that if I was stuck at home, that's the stuff that I would want the people at covering E3 to do.
To actually be there and just be able to see the stuff with my own eyes, it lets me, even in the context of this show, explain things so much better than I could just from watching video.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have understood the full breadth of what Nintendo was doing with the projects. Garden, Giant Robot. I may have, you know, instinctively understood, okay, this is sort of those tech demos that we've heard about. They're just kind of showing off, oh yeah, this Wii U can do some stuff. We've got some ideas. But having played them, I understand these demos were selected for E3 to show off, you know, create an environment around them, create excitement in the location where these things were built. Mm-hmm. They weren't to show off a gameplay concept they're making for a game necessarily. They were meant to show Nintendo has ideas. Nintendo is creative.
Right.
Nintendo can do things with these gamepads you cannot do otherwise. And there's a reason it was back to back with Mario Maker, another intensely creative game. This was their creative play space. This is where you could see, yeah, they've got some ideas for some weird and experimental stuff. Okay, I get the gamepad now.
Mm. Yeah.
That was their gamepad validation corner.
Yep.
And unless I was there, I wouldn't have gotten that.
There's so many ways in which we can provide a service that Nintendo either cannot or will not.
Let's put it this way. We work for you at E3. Yeah. Nintendo's Treehouse people worked for Nintendo.
Exactly. Yes, great summary. Let's move on. So the next email is a doozy. Oh boy.
Is a coward. This is what the next email is.
So this next email is probably one of my favorites that we've ever gotten. And it's not a big discussion. It's mostly just a funny story. When we got this, I died laughing and I said, we absolutely have to put this on the show. So this email comes from Kevin Tate. And he writes, Kevin Tate is not my real name. If it had happened to you, you wouldn't use your real name either. So last fall, I had finally gotten my Wii U and was very excited about getting back into the eShop. One of the first games I downloaded was one I'd missed out on with the Wii, Breath of Fire 2. I had played the first Breath of Fire on the GBA, but never had a chance to play the second one up until now. I had also just started listening to RFN. Where else was I going to hear about Wii U? And had started exploring some of the older episodes. Now, I don't think I'm that uncommon in listening to podcasts while taking a dump.
Oh, we actually do that while we're recording right now, so it's fine.
Yeah, I'm on the John right now.
I meant more metaphorically, but okay, let's go with that.
I find it more sanitary than reading. So I was... That's arguable.
That's not commentary from Johnny. That's in the email.
That's part of the email. So I was cheerfully listening to RFN while doing my business when I run out of toilet paper. It happens sometimes when one must make the awkward journey to find another roll. No big deal. As I'm going about this task, all of a sudden, it happens. Breath of Fire 2 comes up. It sits on my Wii U, freshly downloaded, barely any progress. I prepare myself to pause. James Jones, quote, I don't want to spoil it, though. I let my guard down. There won't be spoilers. I try to finish my task, pants around my ankles. Suddenly, James Jones, quote, but it's a 20-year-old game, so fuck it. Immediately, my hand flies to my inline headset control while I start yelling, la 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 la. My dexterity fails me, and instead I turn up the volume, his voice getting louder and louder as I increase my volume as well, almost screaming as I try to drown out the spoilers echoing in my ears. I make to try to pull the earbuds out, but in doing so, I lose my balance and get fouled up with my jeans around my legs, causing me to fall and smash my head against the bathroom heat register. Next thing I know, my wife is bursting in, and I'm lying on the floor with my pants down, bleeding from my head. All she can say is, how the fuck did this happen? I do not tell her until later. I was rushed to the hospital and received 5 stitches. My head healed, but thanks to my wife constantly bringing it up, my pride never has. James Jones, you are a piece of shit. Love the show. Keep up the good work. All that bullshit.
What's funny is the spoiler I gave is literally the opening sequence of the game. Oh. Like it's before you pick a new game. It is literally, if you've played Breath of Fire 1 and see the opening sequence, it's not a spoiler.
Right, right.
And I think I even say this. It's not really a spoiler. It happens in the first 30 seconds.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
See, but all of that was so lost in the storm, man.
I gave a dude a concussion for basically nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Good job.
Oh, boy.
And to be fair, I've spoken about my concussion I received in RFN-related activities on this show using my real name. So, sir, take your mask off.
Yes. Kevin Tate or whoever you are. All right, so John is going to read the next email.
All right, Daniel writes, I couldn't help but notice Nintendo's strong public showing this past week at E3, not only in regards to my personal opinion of the entire event, but also in regards to female representation, both in their games and in the human presenters, developers, and game players. As far as the games go, both Super Smash Bros. And Hyrule Warriors presented a wide array of playable female characters. Splatoon prominently featured the female Inklings in their promotions, and for better or worse, Bayonetta is a game featuring not only a powerful female protagonist, who I snarkily imagine is a much harder woman to animate than anything Ubisoft refuses to put the effort into animating, but also exclusively feature a female on its box art. And on the flesh and blood side of things, the Treehouse presenters appear to be made up of a sizable number of women. There were female developers featured demoing during the Treehouse streaming and roundtables, and the Super Smash Bros. Invitational tournament featured a nearly equal amount of female players and celebrity guests to male. I want to know your opinions on Nintendo's current and potential future treatment of women in games and gaming. I am especially interested in your opinions on Nintendo's intention to target young female gamers by using games other than stereotypically female fashion or dating games.
You know, we're so unqualified to talk about this.
I'd like to point out that we just got an email about female representation on a show with all four male cast members. That's had females on about 10 out of 400 episodes.
Well, we can certainly be supporters of what's happening here. And
there is a certain amount of irony in it, though.
it's one of those things where I'm sure that Nintendo's characters are not even 50% female, but it feels like way more than any other company is doing. And that's good. And it's especially it's very striking when you compare them to like Microsoft and Sony with their press conferences, where they had very, very few characters like that. And that's not to say that no video games have female characters, but they're, you know, like far less than the actual human population would lead you to expect, maybe.
Right.
And for me, it really is not, and I don't think it's Nintendo trying to be, you know, progressive or trying to make statements or anything like that. And in the past, actually, if you go, you know, like to the, if you go look at the first couple episodes of like Tropes Against Women in Video Games, Nintendo comes out of that looking pretty bad. You know, I mean, they have females in their games, but usually they're in positions of weakness and, you know, needing to be saved, or they're just not really given very much character development. And frankly, Nintendo, you know, historically hasn't been about character development in a lot of their games anyway. There's some change in that. You know, a lot of it is that I think as they're going into HD development, the character models themselves are becoming more detailed. And as the characters become more detailed, I think the players expect for them to have a certain, I don't know, like a certain authenticity.
Well, you know, I mean, like, I would say that to the end, they're spending more time literally building these characters. So it makes sense that they want to use all of them to their maximal effect.
Well, and also they want the characters to look different from each other. And
sure,
you know, having some of them be female, having some of them be not human, having them all be different colors, that helps, you know? And that's something that other game companies don't always put much effort into. So to me, when I look at the cast of Smash Brothers, for instance, I mean, you can look at that, you know, it's a huge array of stuff in a game like that. And you can look at it and say, well, wow, there's a lot of female characters, and some of them are really good. They're some of the best characters to play with, and there's some of the most popular characters. And that's totally true. But for me, when I look at it, mostly I'm just amazed at the variety. There's so much diversity, period. There's all these weird Pokemon creatures, and there's all these weird uniforms.
What the fuck gender is Greninja?
I mean, he's a Pokemon. So, I mean, I guess it would depend on which one you catch in the game.
Yeah.
But it could be either way. And for me, it's just more about – their games are just more the characters are just more interesting. There's more thought put into having these characters be – different and interesting and all over the place. And, I think I don't know what thought went into specifically for a game like Splatoon. I think we just don't know much about it.
I mean, if you look at the video, it's about half and half. I think it's two male characters and two female characters per team, but they all look distinct, which I think, again, to your point, every one of the characters on the team is different. Like they're wearing completely different clothes.
Yeah, I think some people have looked at Splatoon and thought that all of the characters are female. And in my time playing
the game
did not give me that impression. I think
I can tell you definitively it is 50-50.
Yeah, they all have what looks like long hair. And that's part of the character modeling in order to help the transition from the humanoid form to the squid form.
Right. The hair is kind of like their tentacles when they transform.
Exactly. So it may, from afar or at a glance, it may look like they're all female because they all have long hair, but it's more complicated than that. But yeah, there's female characters in the game. I also think Nintendo, you know, because Nintendo is targeting families in a lot of cases, or they're targeting younger people, why not go after females? I mean, yeah. Those are among the people who still are interested in Nintendo. So they'd be stupid to ignore that part of the fan base. Whereas, you know, a lot of these companies, some of these other companies have never traditionally had female fans, or not very many. And so they don't see a need to cater to them. And so over time, it just gets, they get more and more entrenched in whatever demographic that they're targeting. Nintendo's demographic in general is just much broader. And so it makes sense that the characters in their games are broader as well, because they reflect the people who are playing their games.
Right, but they also reflect the people who developed them. I think that one of the reasons, like, Nintendo has cited one of the biggest reasons why Animal Crossing is so popular with female gamers is that they've got a large number of women under development team. I mean, Nintendo courting women is not really a new phenomenon, but they haven't really been this good about it. It wasn't that long ago that
Super Princess Peach
came out, and that game was a nightmare. I mean, it was mechanically, it was all right. It looked good. It was, you know, like, it was a decent platformer.
It's
but
okay. I mean, it's not that great of a game. I mean, it's a little bit of a slap at that character, because I think.
But holy shit! Like, her powers were being moody.
Yeah,
you know, it's like there was a lot of sexism in them, and that was probably, you know, a game made for women but by men who had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to speak to the gender makeup of the development staff of a game that is multiple years old that we don't have in front of us. That may be sure. That may be unfair to the people making the game.
Sure.
Mm.
Like, I don't know. I mean, to me, my takeaway on, I mean, we spoke about what Tilly had on the Treehouse. The Treehouse staff is the Treehouse staff. It is localization.
Mm-hmm.
That is a field that is a fairly diverse field already in terms of gender.
Sure. I'm a translator. My trade is being translator, and my office is mostly women.
Yeah. So it's not super surprising that the Treehouse stream had, you know, people playing the game there were a number of females in that representation. I thought the people they brought to the projects or the Codename Steam panel, one of the three was a woman. I don't think it had anything to do with them trying to strike gender balances. She was an important player in making that game.
Mm-hmm.
I think they picked three people making that game based on what their contribution to the game was. And I think they selected wisely because each of them was able to speak about a different part of the game. I think what happens, as opposed to just trying to give the image of diverse representation, I think that can come off feeling inauthentic.
Sure, like the token
character. Yeah, I think ultimately they just went out and did what they do, and it reflected well on them for it. I think that's really all it comes down to. I mean, they probably made some effort, you know, in terms of who they brought from the Treehouse staff, but I don't think that was probably more based on who's the most presentable.
Yeah, and I mean, I think other companies have moved away. They've moved more exclusively towards appealing to the male, you know, demographic.
Well, I think, I mean,
which makes Nintendo look better. You know what I mean?
There's a reference to the Ubisoft thing here, and that was a PR failure more than anything else. Because ultimately, what you're playing as, it's got nothing to do with modeling female characters. That was stupid. The reason you can only play as male characters in the multiplayer version of that game is everybody's playing the same character. It's the character from the story of the game. They look different because they were the individual player's single player version, and they had customized his outfit.
But I also think that I think that there's perhaps a relationship between various publishers, developers catering mostly to, you know, the male gamer at the beginning of a generation, because I think perhaps, like, I don't know if it's conscious or not, but maybe, you know, like, they know that it's mostly guys who love video games who will buy who will be early adopters.
Right. It goes back to that proposition of buying a video game console near launch is kind of a crazy thing to do.
Yeah.
Right. But I think, you know, usually in a console's life cycle, you see the more family oriented games come out more towards the end.
And look at the Kinect launch on the 360. That system got inundated with these games that are targeting family. I mean, there was a Sesame Street game, multiple Sesame Street games that came out on the 360 in the last 2 years of its life.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm just wondering, like, maybe there's a relationship between Ubisoft being generally good about having, you know, female representation in their games at the end of last generation and all of a sudden kind of being shitty at it.
Yeah, I mean, Ubisoft is funny to me because they like, Assassin's Creed actually has had a lot of good female characters. There's one game that the main character is female.
It's not a very good game, though.
No, and I haven't played that one, but from what I've heard, I mean, they don't over-sexualize her. They don't treat her that much differently than the male characters in the other games. I mean, they handled it respectfully from what I've heard.
They sexualize her in a way that an assassin would use that as one of their tricks.
Okay.
And Child of Light just came out recently.
Yeah,
and,
Child of Light is a great game where most of the characters in that game are female.
Yeah.
And it's really good.
I really think Ubisoft getting stung here is mostly just a PR failure.
Yeah, I mean it's a little bit unfair to that develop. I mean, you could fling that charge at a lot of developers and it would be justified. At Ubisoft in particular, I think they handled the situation really poorly.
Oh, they were. I mean, they didn't know the own reason why all the characters were male.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like really stupid.
Yeah.
If you don't know the answer to the question, say, I'll get back to you, and then go find out.
Yeah. Another thing that people don't talk about that much, but Nintendo of America in particular has had like really good female representation for a long time. They've been a I'm not going to say 50-50, but they've had a lot of very high-profile women within the corporate structure for as long as I've been covering Nintendo. You know, Perrin Kaplan at one point was one of the most successful female executives in America back in the early 2000s, and was like she was getting put on magazine covers and stuff like that, like business magazines. You know, they've had Beth Llewellyn and Cammy, and now they have. Come on, guys.
I can't remember
all of the executives, but
I'm thinking.
Yeah. So it's not always the people running the company, but if you cover Nintendo, if you go interview people at Nintendo, if you are around Nintendo executives, you'll find that a lot of them are women, which is not necessarily the case with other game companies. Mm-hmm. And so I've always thought that they seem to be a little better balanced than is the case with a lot of other companies.
Yeah, they're also publicly traded, you know, and I don't know. That's just...
Well, they are in Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, you know, I'd be curious to see. I'd just be curious to see what their breakdown is in Japan versus the U.S. I'd be curious.
We don't have much insight into that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like with Animal Crossing, I wonder, is it that game is popular with women because there are a lot of women making it, or is it that New Leaf, the most recent game in the series, had a lot of women on the development staff because that series is popular with women? And so women have entered the workforce in game development in Japan, and that's one of the games that they're most excited to go work on.
I would guess it's probably closer to the second.
Yeah.
I mean, it
makes sense. Hey, if Nintendo already knows – like that game was a surprise hit with women, I think. I don't think that game was designed to appeal to women. I think they were kind of surprised by that, and then they capitalized on it, and they didn't screw it up. And now that the series is 15 years old in Japan, so it's been part of people's lives for a long time. And you know, I think there are a lot of women in Japan who grew up with Animal Crossing and are really big fans of it. And it maybe inspired them to want to become game developers. So to me, it makes sense that they have a lot of young women on the staff of making the most recent one. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, I know there was that GDC talk where they discussed it a little bit, but I wonder if that is teaching Nintendo the opportunities that may be there for other franchises as well. Be very curious to find out. But certainly all of their, and I mean pretty much all of their like well-known developers, like, you know, like the people whose names you might recognize, they're all men. And I expect that will change over time, but it's going to take a while.
The same people that have been there since the 80s.
Nintendo did, and you didn't really get to see this because, again, we weren't allowed to take photo or videos during the roundtable. But for Codename Steam, they had a female developer, and I don't know her name off the top of my head. I don't know any of their names, but I'd never seen her before. But
I mean, she said it was her first time in America.
Yeah, yeah. And she said she was like a really big fan of America and was really excited to be there for the first time, especially getting to show this game. But she's worked on Fire Emblem series, worked on Awakening and other intelligent system games, is now the art director for Codename Steam, a game that is like heavily leveraged on an interesting art style.
And she picked the art style for the game.
Yeah, and is responsible for creating a lot of it. And she was demoing the game. She was talking about it. And I think she was one of the only female developers on stage at any point during E3. And it's too bad that Nintendo didn't show that a little better, but, you know, because it was kind of a private closed down.
So they've released the roundtables again on video since then,
mm-hmm.
or at least chopped up versions of them.
She was a really interesting person, you know,
all three of them were
her influences. Yeah, I mean, that the whole presentation was just really kind of fascinating, as like, they've never brought intelligent systems people over to America and let them, you know, talk to the media. So I found it just really fascinating to learn more about that company and the way that they think about things, which, you know, they're not Nintendo. They're kind of a second party. So their attitude is maybe slightly different than you might get from talking with developers who are literally internal to EAD, for instance. But I thought she was great. I thought all the intelligent systems people were really interesting and had like really original thoughts and ways of explaining why they're making Codename Steam a certain way, you know, why they made certain decisions. I really enjoyed hearing all of them talk about that stuff.
Takako Sakai, that's it.
Cool.
I knew I had my notes somewhere.
Yeah. And I really liked hearing her talk about, you know, her American comic book influences and how that translated into the game. And it doesn't surprise me, coming especially off Fire Emblem Awakening. That game had an amazing art design. And I'm really excited to see, you know, how Codename Steam turns out. I think it looks really great, especially in motion. And I'm excited to see what they do next. All right. So Guillaume is going to read the next email.
Sure. Mike writes, do you think Nintendo will extend the Digital Deluxe program beyond December 2014? And if so, how long would the company wait before announcing it? The 10% back has been a nice little cookie to get me to go digital, especially when paired with 20% off eShop card sales at Best Buy.
I would need to know what Nintendo only can see, which is what the breakdown looks like on their side. This promotion is to wean us off buying retail copies, ultimately.
Right. At first, it was also like a kind of an attempt to get people to buy the deluxe console instead of the basic one. But at this point, it's not a selling point anymore.
Right. I think there's only
a couple of months left.
I think that what we'll see is, we'll find out when they decide what the numbers tell them. If the numbers are telling them this is getting people to buy digital copies, they'll gladly give us 10% back because they're still making way more money on it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Right.
They definitely they need some sort of edge to draw indie games and downloadable games and get people to buy them on Wii U instead of PlayStation 4, for instance. Because right now Sony has a pretty convincing argument. For Sony fans who own both the Vita and the PlayStation 4, there's cross-buy, you know? So,
well, and there's PlayStation Plus, which you pay a single subscription and you get free games on all of their platforms.
Yep. Right.
That's a big
incentive.
So
Nintendo needs some sort of competitive edge here and needs to have a reason to get people to go to Wii U first, because they don't have always, 1080p, which is apparently is a very strong argument for the hardcore. some sort of rebate. I don't think they can get away without it.
I love the Digital Deluxe program, and it's done. I've probably gotten almost $100. I don't know, at least $50 of credits from it, and I'm not done yet. But I don't think it has really influenced people's decisions very much overall. And there will be a few people who it's influenced them greatly. But I think probably the number of people who are really taking advantage of it is not that great. And, you know, frankly, they don't advertise it very much. They don't really push it very much. And once you have the system set up, they don't send you reminders to go get those codes. I mean, I think they'd be happy if you forgot that the codes were there and just never redeemed them, because then they save $5.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, the end of 2014, although I would love for it to go on forever, to me, the end of 2014 makes sense as the end of that program because, number one, they've already sold the system to all of the hardcore fans who are going to go and buy everything digitally anyway. By that point, they're, you know, if you're going to take advantage of a program like this, you probably own the system by the end of 2014, and you've probably already been buying games for it. The other thing is, right. I think they want to wean you off of that program. So in other words, they don't have to keep giving you the cash back because you're already invested into the ecosystem. I mean, for me, I'm used to having the games digitally. I'm in the habit of going to the eShop and looking for the latest thing. I like being able to download them at midnight rather than wait for a store to open up the next day when I'm at work. So I'm already buying, I would buy these games digitally even if they didn't give me the cash back. And I think a lot of people would, especially if you started out doing it because of the reward, but then you get in the habit of it, then they can stop giving you the reward, but you're still going to keep buying digitally because you now have learned to appreciate all these other advantages, or it's just force of habit and you've gotten to where you don't feel like going to the store anymore. So in that sense, it may not make a whole lot of sense for them to extend the program because they've kind of already gotten what they wanted to get out of it.
Yeah, they were really just trying to seed the market anyways, and I think they've already done that.
Yeah. I mean, when they first did this back in 2012, it wasn't as common for people to buy all their games digitally. This was before you could buy every single Sony game, for instance, on the PSN store the day it came out. Certainly, but long before you could do that on Xbox. I think with Xbox, that only happened with Xbox One. On 360, that never really was the case. It was very selective what games you could download. And on Wii U, from day one, every single game that they offer, including most third-party games eventually. It was a little bit hit or miss in the early days, and of course now there's not really a whole lot of third-party stuff to speak of, but certainly every single first-party Nintendo game that doesn't require some crazy accessory can be downloaded. In fact, you can usually get it before you can get it at the store, and at least for the same price, if not less. So there's a lot of advantages, and at this point, it's a lot more normal for people to behave that way, and they don't need to incentivize it so aggressively as they did back when the system first launched. You've also got the eShop is shared across 3DS, so if you own both systems, that may additionally reinforce this habit and this style of buying your games and of playing your games. So I just don't think it's necessary anymore, although it's advantageous to me.
I think that if Nintendo wants the new, you know, the future adopters of the Wii U to go to the eShop and download games, they'd be better served including some sort of external hard drive, like maybe a small one,
yeah,
but something to put their games mm-hmm. on. Because that's the true barrier that these people are going to run into.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, I can certainly see down the road, if they ever do some kind of like minor hardware revision on the system, you know, they've already been changing the games that get packed in, but at some point they may get to where, you know, maybe they revise the motherboard to shrink it down a little bit and save money that way or something. They, you know, they take off one of the USB ports.
Remove the component out.
Yeah, something like that. then maybe at that point they might also increase the internal storage. And especially in the back half when you've got people, you know, when you have more of a back catalog and when someone buys the system for a reduced price because it's been out for a few years, you know, a lot of times you're hoping that they're going to immediately go and buy a bunch of games. Well, you'd much rather them buy those off the eShop than to go to GameStop and buy a bunch of used copies. So if you can incentivize them to do that through having good prices on the eShop and also just the convenience factor, you can store all these games on your system. You don't have to swap discs and you don't have to go on eBay and look for deals. They're just right there. In the back half, when you go after the more mainstream consumer, that could be very appealing if they handle that well. And in that case, it may make sense for them to put more internal storage because those are the kinds of people who are not going to go buy a separate hard drive to put it in. I mean, I think it was stupid for them to not have a hard drive built into the system. But at least with the external hard drive option, they know that the early adopters, the more hardcore people who are going to be buying the system, if you really want to download a whole bunch of Wii U games, you're smart enough to go figure out how to do that. And as time goes on, I think you can make fewer assumptions about the kinds of people who are going to buy your system. So it makes sense to me to increase the storage. And also storage gets cheaper over time. So they can do that. They can buy a larger sure. chip for the same price, and then they can, you know, advertise it as a better value for the consumer. So I could see that. One last thing before we move on from this email. Obviously, we've been talking about it, but last week when Pushmo and a couple other things came out, I was reminded someone I think had on Twitter had just sort of casually mentioned the Digital Deluxe program. And I thought, oh yeah, it's been a few months since I logged in and checked to see if I have a code. I had 5 codes waiting for me. That's $25 worth of eShop credit. Some of it had been there for a while, I think. Some of it had come recently because I think you even get $5 for the free game that comes with Mario Kart 8.
Really? I think, interesting.
Yeah, I believe that's the case. But anyway, I had a whole bunch of stuff waiting for me that I had just sort of recently had been forgetting to go claim. So I did that and I thought, you know, I bet I'm not the only one who's in this situation. So I mentioned something about it on Twitter and got a bunch of responses from people who said, oh yeah, thanks for the reminder. I had a whole bunch of credit waiting for me that I just needed to go claim.
I can't remember how to check it now.
So, and that's the other thing. They don't make it very easy. They don't remind you. They don't send you emails saying, hey, have you been by lately? So it's ddp.nintendo.com. ddp.nintendo.com. You go there, you sign in with your Nintendo Network ID, the same one that you use on Miiverse, and a password that you I think is the same thing that you use for Miiverse also, or your profile on the yes. system. And you log in there, and it'll tell you if you have a code. It keeps track of all that stuff. All your purchases, it keeps track of automatically from when you registered the console. And go on there, because if you haven't looked at it in a while, you might have a significant amount of eShop credit. And that's like, even if it's not enough to buy a new full price game, it might be enough to download something from the Virtual Console or one of these smaller games. Maybe it's enough to get you Treasure Knight when you thought you couldn't afford it for a while. So if you have a black Wii U, definitely go check that out.
Yeah, you do get points for, because I got Pikmin 3 with Mario Kart 8, and I got 599 mm-hmm. points for it.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to reveal the listeners a dirty little secret. We when we get review copies for Wii U games and we get them downloadable, we do get the
yep.
digital deluxe points.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have been, you know, taking money hats from Nintendo.
Straight. Yep.
Okay, guys. Well, we have to wrap up the show. We'll do more listener mail as soon as possible. Again, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And thank you so much to everybody who wrote in, whether we got it on the show or not. We really do appreciate
Even
it.
Even if you didn't use your real name.
That's right. We love hearing from people. We love the funny stories. We love the insightful questions. And we're happy for you to challenge us on what we say on the show. And we like the chance to respond and hopefully to shed some additional light onto whatever we've been talking about, whatever is going on with Nintendo. So thank you very much for your attention and for your contributions. You make the show better. Before we go, a couple of quick plugs. I just last night recorded a new space segment with our friend Scott Thompson from Connectivity, and that will be on this weekend's episode of Connectivity. I think hopefully it will be out by the time this airs or maybe the day after. So if you don't normally listen to Connectivity, go check that one out and subscribe. And that will be a bonus segment over there. And I think in about a week or so, I'll probably put up on Crosstalk as well if you want to find it that way. But we talk about spacesuits for about 45 minutes, and it was super fun to do. And I know there are a lot of fans of those segments. We haven't done one since the telethon back in November, so it's been quite a while. And they're always really entertaining for me personally, and hopefully informational for you guys too. So go learn about space on a Nintendo podcast. That's the world I live in, people. Also, we've been recording it very consistently, but the movie show that I'm on, Box Office Poison, has not been publishing lately. We've gotten really behind on editing, and we're starting to catch up on that. So I think by the time you hear this, probably 3 episodes will have gone up in the past week. So if you want to find out our opinions on all the summer movies and some of the other crazy stuff going on, we've got a couple of really interesting movies of the month that'll be covered in those episodes. BOP is a really fun show. It's all RFN alumni. So these are people whose voices you might recognize from other podcasts or older episodes of this podcast. And now we're talking about movies. And it's a good time of year to start listening to Box Office Poison. So you'll find that over at crosstalk.com, or you can look it up on iTunes, and you'll enjoy it, I promise. So that's it. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week.
Bye. Later.
Remember, we're listening to RFN, wear a helmet.